Hey, since we're all here, I would love to meet some of the people we have online if they're up for it. We have about 8 minutes before we start.
Nicole, but say real quick, I'm having a hard time seeing the screen. Is your presentation up yet? Because I don't see it.
No, I don't have anything up yet.
Okay.
Or I can put it up.
It's okay. I want to make sure I'm logged in properly. And Nicole, I love your idea. Sorry, I just needed to get all settled in.
I would love to hear who else is on the line and, maybe since we have a few minutes, what you are hoping to get out of the webinar. And it looks like we have someone from area code 831. Maybe it looks like we might have someone from 404. Laura, are you on the line? Maybe this doesn't work. You never really can make these webinars too interactive.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah. Are you Laura?
Yeah. Hi, how's it going?
Great. You want to introduce yourself? We figured we would get to know our audience since we have a few people on. Where are you from?
I'm originally from Atlanta, Georgia, but I'm living in Puerto Rico and working on a bike share startup down here.
Oh, the Puerto Rico system.
Yep.
Fantastic. And what stage are you guys in?
We are currently working on closing our financing.
Got it.
So,
And
negotiating with the municipality. It's a really interesting position, and I'm curious about this NAVSA webinar because we're in those details of figuring out who is going to be taking part of what aspects of the business, and that's part of our negotiations that we're going through right now.
Got it.
So it's an interesting stage to be in.
So we will hope to address that. Let's see who else we have. It looks like we have someone from 808, maybe a Dean Silver.
Hey, Nicole, it's Sean Co. I'm the 301 number, but people are muted and it's hard to.
Yes.
You have to click and then it says, it's not intuitive to unmute yourself. So
tell people? Is it a star one,
okay,
or how did you unmute?
No, it depends how you connected, but I'm connected where the thing called my phone.
Yes. Yep.
And so if you did it that way, it looks like if you click on the arrow and then to the right, and then it says it doesn't say unmute. It says, like, enable or something.
It says resume.
Resume, yeah.
Got it. You know, one thing we might do is if people are in quiet places, perhaps we will have everyone unmute themselves. We're going to try to take questions from the group while we talk. So, Sean, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, so hi, everyone. I'm Sean Co. with Tool Design Group, and we do a lot of site share planning, feasibility, and various markets all across the U.S., so including one in Sacramento, and actually they will be joining. There's a whole group of people in Sacramento that will be joining. They might be on, actually. And then so they're the ones who sort of helped organize this for the Sacramento project.
Yep. Great. Thank you, Sean. I want to see if anyone else wants to introduce themselves. Dean Silver, if that's you from 808?
Yes, this is me. And I'm finally figuring out the muting part of it. So I'm on the Big Island of Hawaii.
Awesome. Okay.
Pardon me?
That's fantastic.
Thanks. It's a good place to live, truly.
Yeah.
And we're starting off a bike share program on the west side of the island in Kailua Kona.
Yep.
We're in a process of working with the county to develop a pilot project, and we're in the last stages of it, actually.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
It's going to be very valuable to help us get started. That's what we're hoping for, certainly. So, the group that I'm a part of is People's Advocacy for Trails Hawaii.
Okay, fantastic. So, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for this opportunity.
great. And for everyone else that's on, we have a few minutes till we start, so I thought we would just hear from a few of you to hear what you're interested in and who you are and have you introduced yourself. We have, I want to see 574 Dan Remington, if you want to introduce yourself, if you can figure out how to unmute. Or we have someone at 844 area code. If you guys want to try, I would love to hear who you are. I've been told that there's about an 8-second delay in figuring out how to unmute. It looks like the, you are both still muted. Sam Shelton or Andrew Bremitz, would either of you want to introduce yourself?
Oh, actually, Dan,
there you are.
I just got unmuted. Sorry about that.
Great. Dan, say hello. Who are you? And
hello.
Cool.
I'm from Indianapolis, Pacers Bike Share. Just kind of joining this to be along for the ride. If I have anything to add, I'll be sure to join in.
Great. Dean, you already introduced yourself. Anyone, one last introduction? We have about 2 more minutes. We have an Andrew Bremitz and a Sam Shelton. If either of you guys can figure it out. We have someone from area code 225 as well. Oh, 225, who are you? You're our mystery.
This is Lauren Jumenville. I'm at the Baton Rouge Area Foundation.
Yep, and tell us about where you are and what you are doing.
So we are at the very early stages of this and are trying to put together a task force of interested stakeholders, and I'm hoping a few of them will be able to join me on the call today. But we intend to engage a firm to look at a feasibility and business plan and then hopefully implement bike share soon.
That's great. Fantastic. Thank you. And is there any specific thing that you would like to learn from today?
I think one of the things we're struggling with is the differences in operational models and looking at different equipment vendors and operational vendors and public-private and nonprofit, all the different pieces and what makes sense for us.
Great. So it just rolled over to 9 o'clock. So I am a fan of being punctual. So I'm going to start kicking off today. Good morning, everyone. And we're excited for our first webinar of 2017 from the North American Bike Share Association. And I'm so excited that so many of you decided to join today. I'm Nicole Friedman. I'm the president of NAPSA. And I also work in Seattle overseeing active transportation and, you might guess, bike share. And we have 2 guests today who are presenting. We have Mirtha Mallory. She is the executive director of WeCycle in Aspen. And we have Lindsay West, who is the executive director of the Zip Bike Share System in Birmingham. And for those of you that don't know, they just launched this September. Congratulations, Lindsay.
Thank you.
So what's this, we titled this Operating Bike Share in Small and Medium-Sized Cities. And why we put on this webinar is we've heard from a lot of our members after our annual conference that they really want to, you know, hear about a little bit more about our operations, and particularly because many of the systems coming online in the next few years are small and mid-sized cities. We wanted to have this webinar be responsive to our members and also begin to help facilitate a discussion among many of these small and medium-sized cities. What we hope to do today is really talk about, how to make the decision about whether to operate locally or perhaps use a third party. And, you know, what are the considerations? How would you operate a system? What is actually involved? Because I can guarantee you there is no degree that one can get in bike share operations. Some of the topics we're going to discuss today, of course, is the decision-making and the logistics. We'll actually address the equipment ownership, which I think Lauren from Baton Rouge just brought up. We'll talk a little bit about that relationship with government and, you know, how important is it and what do you do if you have high support or low support. And we can talk about some of the advantages and disadvantages of a local ownership. The last thing I want to do before we start is just mention the format. We are actually trying a slightly different format today, and I'm hoping it works really well. We want this to be a very interactive session. So Mirta and Lindsay are, for just a couple of minutes, going to introduce their systems. I have a number of questions to prompt them, but we actually do want questions from you, our audience, and to keep this a conversation. This is about getting you the information that you want. So I'm going to suggest something. If you are in a quiet place, and I realize this may be bad webinar format, but I want to try having everyone unmute or at least know how to unmute so that if you have a question, you can actually jump in with that question. And I wish there was a way that you guys could flag me to let me know you had a question. That would make it much easier. But there is not a good way to do that, so we will have you jump in. And I'll prompt you guys. I'll ask if there are questions from the audience. But know that we do want questions. So with that, I want to hand it over to Mirta to do a quick system overview and tell us a little about the goals of your system. Thank you, Mirta.
Fantastic. Thanks, Nicole, for a great introduction, and thanks for moderating this session. And welcome to everyone who has joined from, sounds like, all over the country. If we can transition to the next slide here, we'll get a quick introduction to WeCycle, which is based here in Aspen, Colorado. I'm the co-founder and executive director of this organization, which was founded in 2013. We are a PBSC-based system that has currently 16 stations and 100 bicycles. From the one end of our system to the other is 2.4 miles, and we have had riders who have completed docking at every station within half an hour. Granted, they have ridden very quickly to do so. Our system was primarily founded as a transportation system with the goals of reducing congestion and improving air quality. Though we are a small town of only 6,500 residents, we do have 11,000 people who commute into Aspen every day to work, and we balloon to about 25,000-30,000 during the peak seasons in the summer and the winter. So we have congestion challenges, parking issues, and the goal of WeCycle is to alleviate some of those challenges by having individuals hop on a bike to get to and from. And we've seen so far that 62% of our ridership are actually our season pass holders. So we're primarily a pass holder transit system. Fewer visitors are partaking in our system, but those who do greatly enjoy it. And the system short rides, 8 minutes is our average ride time. And we are looking to open on our fourth season coming in May. We are seasonal due to the winter season and beginning to look at a regional system as well. Just as a one note, our presenting sponsors are Aspen Soma Sotheby's, and our title sponsor is Adidas Outdoor, which you can see here on this image in the bike. So there's Aspen for you. From here, we'll transition to Birmingham.
Lindsay, thank you, Martha. Lindsay, tell us a little bit about Birmingham and Zip Bike, which, of course, just launched in September.
Yes. We ended up launching in October, but if we could change the slide as well. We have 40 stations around our downtown area with 400 bikes, and 100 of our bikes are electric pedal assist technology, so we are the first electric pedal assist bike share program in North and South America, so very exciting for our medium-sized city. We have about 215,000 people that live here. If you take the kind of broader kind of metro area, then we're at 1.1 million, but really focused down into the 215 in the more in the core of the city and the surrounding neighborhoods that are directly feeding into this downtown area. So we are a year-round system, open 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. And we're under a nonprofit structure. The main goals for our system were very similar to Aspen's. We have congestion mitigation air quality funds used to fund the capital piece of our program. So that is obviously a goal of ours to reduce the congestion and improve air quality. Parking can be a premium especially during the week, during when a lot of people come in from the suburbs to work at the businesses downtown. And at times it gets pretty congested. Connectivity and vibrancy were another big goal of ours, really providing additional transportation options for individuals while they were downtown and connecting them to the various entertainment districts and our activities that we have and providing that option. And then the health piece was also very important to us because the state of Alabama is ranked very poorly and being very obese. So we wanted to address that possibly with some health alternatives through bike share. And just real quick, our main sponsors are Regions Bank, which is headquartered here, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alabama, hence the green and blue bike. Alabama Power also came to the table. Our community foundation was extremely involved. And then we leveraged federal dollars as well,
You know, I have to say one thing that I appreciate is there used to be a discussion that in the large cities, you know, they really were ahead of time and really understood about congestion and health and connectivity and vibrancy. But it is nice to see that now that really seems par for the course for small cities, both in Birmingham and Aspen, to really understand those as issues and try to address those. You know, I want to ask you, Lindsay, you know, you're a city of about 212,000, so a fairly sizable city, and your system could grow quite sizable. How did you make the decision to have a local operation?
Well, we worked through a feasibility study and an implementation plan with Tool Design Group, which was very helpful and kind of led us to some of our decisions. We were going to actually implement under a government entity at first, and through that feasibility study, we changed our minds and realized that nonprofit was a better way to go for us, and we linked up with Rev Birmingham, who's known for being a community organization already that's an implementing organization really focused on vibrancy and filling vacant spaces and all types of things downtown. So we linked up with them to actually implement, and we realized, too, that that opened a lot of doors for our sponsorship and really helped us secure those funds that were needed. So it gave us a lot more flexibility, and that government entity that was going to run the system originally is still very much a player at the table and involved, and I think at the end of the day it worked out from their business model to the nonprofit that we linked up with that we did not do that. And the entity I'm talking about is our regional planning commission was the original goal, but that shifted and it actually worked a lot better for us, I think, in the long run.
And what were you doing before? Where were you?
I was at the regional planning commission. So that's one of the, I guess the next slide is about some of the challenges that are faced through operating bike share and some of the things to consider. And one of the things that I was going to mention was hand tallying. I was at the planning commission, so I was able to devote a large amount of my day and my time to this project. And without that ability, if it would have been an afterthought or a piece of someone's job, but which was a piece of mine, but it quickly became a large piece, 50-70% of my time. And without having that person dedicated to seeing this through, it really can stall and or slow down. And so I think manpower is a very important thing. And so I was at the Planning Commission before. I switched over to operations once we got to a certain point and secured some community foundation money. And I was hired on. Because I knew, at that point, I knew the most about the program, and I was willing to make the leap because I believe in bike share. So, and if you want, I can go through some of the other, I'm covering opportunities, but.
I'd love you to go through the small city opportunities if you would.
Okay, great. Well, high probability of successful nonprofit governance, I think there's already usually a strong link between local government and nonprofit in smaller communities. It's usually already just some kind of contractually or relationship-based piece, and so I think that the probability of that happening in a smaller community opposed to a large city is definitely lends to an opportunity for cities of our size and smaller. Easier permitting and deployment of system, this was so important to us. And we had to change some ordinances, and so working with the city on that, it certainly was easier to get those things done and expedited, which allowed for bike share to come into Birmingham. And I think a lot of cities go through that, and that is definitely something you want to start talking about early because it can take a while to go through lawyers, city, and through your city council and go through the proper steps, but it is easier for sure. And then simplicity of rebalancing, just not having to deal with possibly as much congestion on your street. You can navigate to those much easier from an operations standpoint, and I think your users, too. It's an opportunity for them to navigate much easier between stations. And, you know, that lends to the high probability of replacement of car trips with that simplicity of getting from station to station and opening up that connectivity to these fun entertainment districts or restaurants or retail spaces. That it, I think you will see in a smaller city, it's a lot more compact without as much congestion, that people are mentally, they are willing to try it when possibly in a larger city where you have more of those challenges, they are less, they're more hesitant to jump on a bike and get in the traffic. So,
And so we're discussing the small city opportunities. In essence, this is when people are saying, oh, you know, bike share is just about big cities. Maybe it can't work in small cities. What this is saying to me is, no, actually small cities not only can it work, but there are some real advantages, whether it's simpler, you know, the simplicity of permitting or rebalancing, perhaps even more effective at some of the congestion, reduced congestion reduction goals. So I think that's quite interesting. Anything else on the opportunity?
And Nicole, I just want to add, too, to an opportunity to that. I think that small and medium-sized cities can truly be catalysts of change for larger cities, and that they can be kind of a door opener for individuals who try bike share. And as Lindsay was discussing, a smaller context, perhaps less congested, fewer cars, and so that sense of kind of being daunted by being in a huge cityscape with cars and taxis and not knowing where you're going can be at times overwhelming for your first time for bike share. And I think that goes back and forth. We definitely see a lot of individuals who have bike shared in major cities and then come here and have the opportunity in a much more quiet context. But we also hear a lot of stories from our riders that I've seen it in cities, I live in a major city, but I've just been daunted by the process. And now that I've done it here while I'm on vacation and while I'm using it for a very determined purpose, I have gone back to my own community and am now a regular bike sharer and have become a season pass holder in my community. So I think that small cities really have that opportunity to catalyze change.
Martin, that is wonderful. And something that Martin and I actually have talked about in late prior to this is that we can go, from an operational standpoint, that we can kind of move and be a little bit more flexible as nonprofit local operators with the ebbs and flows of our community. And so as our community develops or changes or something becomes more of a trend, we can kind of change with that. We're much more nimble and able to operationally change even grassroots from a marketing standpoint. It's very effective in bike share. We can do that easier and in some cases better because we're local. And so we've talked a lot about that, being able the flexibility to change with your community. It's great. Awesome. It's a great opportunity.
Fantastic. And now moving to the negative.
yeah. On the next slide, we have challenges.
tell us about some of the challenges you face as being a small or medium-sized city.
Yeah, I think it's small, too. We'll transition to the next slide here. I think in small to medium-sized cities, I think there's really that unknown of will bike share work. There isn't the density, and the population is smaller. I think one of the concerns as well is you have fewer opportunities to convince people because you have fewer people. And so when you have to come out in a very positive way and engage the correct partners. In our particular case, you're small enough that if you lose 100, 200 people and they have bad experiences, that spreads very quickly through a small community where you have that larger opportunity to engage other people in a bigger city. So that's one of the challenges, and you have the density to support a station. And that has been, is a challenge in a small, medium-sized city, and that's why the station locations are really critical, and trying to understand, as Lindsay was discussing, the nodes of where people will be riding to and from. And the great part about a lot of bike share stations is they're mobile, and so you can move them to adapt to those demands. We can all acknowledge that we have smaller media markets. And that has been a challenge in terms of the dollars that you can bring in. As a result, one has to be more creative. Perhaps it's not the large title sponsorship with naming rights of a system, but you are using more creative ways of breaking down the elements of your bike, in our case, So we don't sell everything in one capacity because we don't have an audience that will be able to bring in one title sponsor, but we are able to bring in different components at lesser values who all have an engagement in the system, and thereby you have more buy-in. So the smaller media market has challenges, but it also has opportunities in that case. And a lot of small to medium-sized cities' existing regional transportation systems are more limited, and so perhaps you have fewer opportunities to connect to those transit authorities. We're really privileged. That is not our case. We have the third largest transportation system in Colorado is in the Roaring Fork Valley just outside of the Denver metro area. And so we're very privileged to have that connectivity to transportation, and that WeCycle can really be used as a first last mile option. However, that isn't the case in all rural areas. And as we know in the United States, the land use pattern of rural areas has been suburbia with highways and a very car dependent culture. And so how does bike share fit into that model continues to be a challenge that I think has not fully been transformed yet in the bike share industry. And I think there also are perceptions of how do you change a local culture that might not be as bike-centric. Transit might not be as much, public transit might not be as much a way of life in smaller to rural areas. And so how can bikes perhaps engage individuals to become more eager transit riders and also change the paradigm towards transit? Do you have the bike infrastructure? Do you have bike lanes? Do you have separated bike lanes? Is there a bike culture to begin with? We have a very avid recreational bike culture, but ironically, we don't have as much of that kind of commuting county culture. And so how can bike share be a catalyst in terms of getting people comfortable riding around their streets? And what we tend to find is that bike share and infrastructure follow each other. So in some cities, you see infrastructure leading the way and then bike share comes next. Or you can have the bike share come and then there's a demand and a public outcry for more infrastructure. And hopefully they can come concurrently. But that there are routes established, where are people going, where are the safest ways to ride. And I think in smaller towns, because it's unknown, there's perhaps a gap of political leadership to make bike share a reality in communities.
Yeah.
Can it work? Is it something that is proven? Do I want to take the risk as a political leader to bring bikes to my community? And it has taken time to get to that place. And I think it's important to have your leaders on board in a small community because they are the faces of the community. You want them out riding the bikes. You want them to be really a part of being advocates for it, and that helps in a tremendous way.
So, Mirta, tell me this. Let's go back to step one. In a lot of our cities that are on the call are there. You are an individual. You're in the town, and you say, I really want to start bike share. How do you establish a relationship with the city government? How important is that relationship? And where do you start? How do you make the case to them?
We went to the city. The city, in our case, we're really fortunate, has established goals of reducing traffic congestion improving air quality. And so the city had stated these objectives of reducing greenhouse gases. And so we were able to go to the city and say, listen, you have these stated goals. You have stated to have a multimodal transportation system. Bike share can be one of the tools to help you accomplish those goals. We can help you, and let us be your bike share entity to help make a difference in a small way of your first last mile. We know we can't replace all of the modes, but that we can have a tangible difference for certain trips. And mm-hmm. So it took a lot of convincing. We started this process in 2010 when there were very few. Your system, Nicole, is one of ours that we were able to look to in Boston for some inspiration, and we were able to look to systems in Denver, in Colorado, which was really helpful. But bike share at that time was bike share what? And so trying to get individuals of our political leadership to understand what bike share was. And then it was helping them understand that we were aligned with their community goals and that they didn't want to take the risk on their own. And so we were asking them to become a partner. And so we created what was called a founding partner circle, and we asked them to join in the effort to be a leader in sustainable transportation solutions along with other private entities. And so we formed a public-private partnership as a nonprofit. And so we convinced the city that they had to try this, that they weren't taking the risk alone, but that they have reached out to the public and say, help us achieve our goals, and that's what we were doing.
So it sounds like putting it in their words. You are accommodating their goals and a lot of time and a lot of persistence. I want to change the subject because I know a lot of our audience wants to focus on a little bit of the operations. So I really do want to delve into when you guys were just starting, how did you make the decision of whether this should be government-owned or nonprofit-owned, or government-owned or third-party-owned, in your case, nonprofit? And how did you make the second decision of local operations versus third-party operations? Because you can have any combination. You can have a government system that has a for-profit operator. You could have a nonprofit that also has a for-profit operator. Or in both of your cases, you are nonprofit and you do operations yourself. How did those decisions get made?
Can we go to the next slide, too? I think that will help us talk about that and answer those questions. And we can talk about our kind of org chart as well.
So we made the decision from the get-go to be a nonprofit. We had models in Colorado, we were fortunate, both Boulder and Denver were nonprofit organizations as well. And so we realized that the city wasn't going to own or operate the system. We built a lot of good political will, but at the same time we realized there were a lot of important factors by being independent. We could be more nimble, we would have more successful partnerships with the private sector, and it allowed us to be more creative perhaps and at times more expedient in certain decisions. And it allowed us to partner with the city without necessarily being viewed as a city organization. And so we have a board of directors who are great advisory and have very good strategic input. They are a combination of community leaders. And then we have an advisory board as well. We are a very small organization, as you see here. And I think I just want to draw attention to the fact that our partners are a very important part of our organization. While they are not involved in day-to-day operations, we wouldn't be able to exist as a nonprofit without our partnerships with these organizations. So though we are an independent nonprofit, that relationship is at times challenging with the city because, as all of our communities do, we have a lot of nonprofits. And so how does the city distinguish between a transportation nonprofit and a social services nonprofit in terms of collaborating with them and in-kind support and permitting forgivenesses and partnering on marketing strategies? And so that's been a relationship that has been evolving, and we continue to nuance. But it's an important so that we can do things independently as a nonprofit, but then partner with them as we do. We have a very strong relationship with our transit authority, which is critical because we are positioning ourselves as a transportation solution. So we collaborate through lots of marketing and events and pass opportunities to be able to really leverage the extensive transportation engagement and buy-in throughout the valley.
So it seems very clear, and I think Lindsay got at this as well. If you are a local nonprofit that is going to own the system, you are still in many ways connected at the hip with your local government. You know, it is a very tight public-private partnership because you're so dependent on them for many of these things. One other question, and maybe Lindsay might want to answer this one. When is it better for perhaps a small city not to be the owner and or not to do the operations locally?
Man, that's a great question. I think you really got to look at your political environment, your local environment, and what has been set up, you know, in years past with certain projects. And not to locally operate. I'm just such a huge advocate for locally operating small businesses in smaller by tier programs. So that's really a challenge for me to answer. That I guess one of the things, if there is a political leadership, if your city is just completely disinterested in this system, then that would be a good time to probably contract that out because they have experience with navigating the waters in larger governances that are probably much more complicated. So that may be a time when I would not promote local operations, but there's probably not many times you're going to find me not promoting local operations to small and medium-sized cities. So.
Yeah, yeah. And tell me this, what do you do? So day one, you decide you're going to be not just, you know, you're a nonprofit, you're going to be operating the system. How do you start? You probably, I imagine you knew nothing about operations. And then you probably have a few months to get this up and running. Where do you start? How do you gain the knowledge?
Well, if you want to click to the next slide, Matt, too, I can kind of talk about our the way we organized our structure, because we are a touch different than Aspen. But I'll answer your question, too, which is I called people like you, Nicole, and Marta, and I called...
I don't think it was very helpful. I don't know. I ride a bike.
I called Charlotte, North Carolina. I called Chattanooga, Tennessee. I called other peer cities that were in size and operationally similar to what we were thinking about doing. I visited them as well, doing site visits, and just asked them all kinds of questions. Luckily, we have a bike share community where it tends to be, especially the nonprofit ownership model, where they will talk to you, show their system to you, talk about some of their challenges, and sometimes open their books to you, which I was very fortunate to have. But I did a ton of research on the ground. I did not just go by what our consultants told us, yet what they told us was very good information, and it was leveraged greatly here. But I spent a great deal of time visiting other systems and taking some of my leadership with me, doing conference calls and due diligence conference calls as well, and digging in. So, that's how I learned about operations. I went to conferences as well, like ProWalk, ProBike, and NASA's annual summit, and there's a lot of great information that exists there. And that's one of the things that I did to introduce myself to all the equipment vendors before our RFP went out, and I might be jumping ahead, but I went to ProWalk, ProBike at the time, and I met almost all of them, and it gave me a chance without an RFP to kind of assess and really ask some hard-hitting questions that possibly once the RFP was released, wouldn't be able to ask. So doing that due diligence before you put your RFP out is also very important if you have to go through the RFP process.
What are the best decisions? Actually, I want to ask you a little bit. What are the best decisions you have made in terms of setting up your operations? And a little bit, how have you done it? Is your customer service in-house?
Yeah.
How big is your team? Tell us some of the details.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the reasons we decided to go local, which was one of your questions earlier, was instead of contracting it out, was it was cheaper for us to go local. We loved the idea of creating jobs, which you can see we've created about 8.5, and then a seasonal position as well. And we wanted to control our messaging because we felt it was so important, just like Marta said earlier, that really quickly if somebody has that experience, it can spread across the community because they're small and people talk. We wanted to be able to control that message as well as control our pricing. We were not willing to give up the ability to control our pricing and go with those ebbs and flows of the community I was speaking about earlier. So those are a large amount of those are the main reasons that we went local with our operations. And after we did our fundraising, and we did 5 years worth of fundraising up front, we wanted to have a solid foundation, and we had learned from other communities that maybe did 2 years of funding or 3 years, that 5 years was probably a better practice. And so we were able to get 5 years up front so we could hire the staff members that you see on the screen. And one of the best decisions, I think, was going nonprofit and not going under that government entity. Yet they're still extremely involved. They're on an advisory committee to this day, and/or not going through the city was because we were able to work through and make decisions much faster and not get hung up in the bureaucracy to a degree that sometimes the public sector. And I come from the public sector, so know that I'm a friend of the public sector, but sometimes can get caught up in which would have possibly postponed or held up our bike share program from happening in 2015. So there were partners at the table, very involved, but having that nonprofit structure really helped us to form the team that we have. And going with Rev Birmingham, an existing nonprofit, which is what we did, instead of starting our own nonprofit, We are a wholly owned subsidiary under Rev Birmingham. And we were set up as a wholly owned subsidiary so we can branch off and have the flexibility to branch off on our own later as well as for liability reasons. But we answer to Rev's overall board, but then we have our officers and we have our advisory committee that we answer to very closely that's made up of our sponsors and our city and the planning commission or the MPO that we respond to. And then I was able to start hiring due to some funding coming in from the Community Foundation and other sponsors. And that, I mean, some of the going nonprofits for us and making those decisions early and acting on them and not just overthinking them but getting our best practices behind us was one of the best things that we did. And going through that feasibility
thing
helped us.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of
Nicole, can I hop in quickly?
I would love you to.
Nicole,
yes, please.
I just wanted to add that I think there, as Lindsay's enumerated, there are a lot of very important advantages to being a nonprofit, from flexibility to nimbleness, self-operated, I should say. So to clarify, the advantages to being self-operated, it's critical that you're on the ground. You can, within a day, change an operational procedure because you and your team get together, you're out on the street, and you see that it's not working, and so you change protocols. And you run into someone who has had a bad experience, and you can adjust to it accordingly. You can change language. You can be quick, nimble, and collaborative, which I think is really important, and it is much more cost-effective because you can be really creative in how you use your resources, who your partners are, what you can get in kind is a really important component of it. But I don't want to underestimate the importance of your vendor in allowing you to be an independent, a nonprofit self-operated system, because if you don't have the tools to self-operate, then it's very challenging to do so. And so I think for those systems who are considering vendors and considering self-operation, really look at what back-end management software comes with the system that allows you to understand the health of your system, gives you balancing tools, gives you customer management tools, and how kind of independent can you be? Because it takes a lot of time to develop best practices, and we know that large for-profit operators have the resources to invest and are operating a lot of systems, and so they have developed some excellent, efficient systems. And so there's a lot to be learned and to be gained from those systems. And the question is, can you work with your provider to be able to kind of not reinvent the wheel and to be able to move quickly to an efficient operational system? And I think so those are important questions to ask your vendor, your potential vendor.
So a really turnkey back-end software solution.
Correct.
Well, and you touched on this, but when you set up your contract with your sponsors, not giving them that operational control, that's so vital. And with your city, when you're setting up this contract, I mean, our contracts took us extremely long, not a long time, as well as the amount of contracts we have underneath BikeShare is probably overwhelming to some, but we never gave up our operational control and linking up with an existing nonprofit that has great relationships with the sponsors as well as the city helps leverage some of those points in those contracts. But I would reach out to an existing system when you're going through your contract piece. There are several points throughout the time. When you're looking at planning and feasibility, great time to reach out to other systems that exist. When you're selecting your vendor, great time to reach out to other systems that exist and use that vendor. And when you're setting up your contracts, great other time to reach out to other systems. So I would say continually communicating with the industry, the BikeShare industry, throughout your process. And I still do now that we operate from an operational standpoint. So always being connected with that BikeShare community, with our industry, is important.
Yeah. So one thing I want to do is turn it over to the audience and see what questions anybody has. And I know many people right now are not on mute, but if there's any questions from the audience, we'd love to take those and make sure we start making it really interactive.
And Matt, the rest of our slides are just pictures, so if you want to click through those slowly as we answer questions so people can get a feel for our systems, that would be great.
I've got a question. Can y'all hear me?
Yeah.
Hey, can you give you guys give examples, I guess, of what local ordinances you had to change before you implemented the system?
Yeah, I'm from Birmingham. From Birmingham, ordinances we had to really focus on was our bike ordinances. We had some really outdated ordinances around in the transportation ordinance around bikes, you know, including you had to have a bell and you had to have a license plate. I don't know. So when they dug them out and blew off the dust, it was really quite a funny meeting. But so our bike transportation ordinance from bicycles was one. And the other ones that we really focused on was the signage ordinances, which would not allow for us to have ad panels, which is a source of revenue for our system. And so
right.
We really had to go around the signage. Luckily, the time was right for them to be revising the signage ordinances from bus shelters to on sidewalks and right-of-way, what we can and cannot do. And they carved out, I mean, they basically put in there, unless you are bike share. So, and I'm happy to share any of our ordinances with you. But those are the two main ones, I would say, that we had to spend a substantial amount of time on.
Is there anything else other than those?
The one we had to deal with was parking in the bike share stations in the public right-of-way, taking up parking places. So we have navigated through that.
Any other audience questions? I want to keep going with the audience questions.
Can you all hear me?
Yeah. Who are you?
Great. I'm Andy Bemis. I'm with the City of Tucson. We are also working with Tool Design Group right now. We've completed our feasibility study, and we've secured capital funding. We're in the process of negotiating for sponsorships and clearing our site location.
Your question?
I would like to know if you can talk about any lessons learned in your search for sponsorships, and you know, how long that took, what were the negotiations like, how did you do your outreach, and also, now that you've launched, what is your Farebox recovery like relative to your projections?
We started with our task force during the feasibility study, and we were very strategic about who was on that task force, and it was absolutely people we knew we were going to ask funding from. We got them engaged very early in the process, and so I would say when our task force was formed in 2013, which we launched in 2015, they were engaged from 2013 on. Now, we started more heavily asking for the actual funds we needed in early 2014. And negotiations happened throughout 2014. We secured our two main ones by the end of 2014. So, I mean, it takes a substantial amount of time. I would not underestimate that, the amount of time that it will take for some of these businesses to make their decisions, especially if you're asking for a large amount of dollars. We did $2.2 million worth of fundraising because we needed to cover the operations for 5 years. So, depending on what you're asking for and the amount, as well as getting in line with Community Foundation's funding cycle and their priorities, understanding those, that usually is a process that happens early the year prior, as well as the MPO. If you use federal dollars, a lot of times you have to go through your MPO for that. So getting in line with their cycle and meeting with that MPO director and trying to figure that out. So all of that took a lot of coordination and a ton of time. And so I would say that for sponsorship contracts, that also took quite a amount of time, and we probably didn't have all of those shored up until mid-2015. As far as the contracts, we had the commitments, but not the actual in writing. So, I mean, we're talking at least a year and a half, if you include the task force timing, 2 years. But that needs to be a part of the efforts from the beginning in my work, in my experience. And I don't remember the second part of the question, but maybe Marissa can.
I'll add to two things on that on sponsorship. One is, I think, talk to everyone, anyone, don't underestimate any relationship, and getting political leaders as well as leaders of large businesses within your community as advocates and voices for you in reaching out to sponsors. It's word of mouth. It's about relationships and timing. Who might be wanting a presence in your market at that point in time? And so be creative, be open, and be persistent on the sponsorship side of things. On the Farebox recovery side of things, we're pleased with our Farebox recovery with regards to rural transportation. We are lower, however, than our projections, because we had projected much higher overtime fees than we are bringing in. We'd anticipated many more day pass holders riding for an extended period of time and hence bringing in those late fees, usage fees, overtime fees, however you choose to call them. And because we haven't brought that in, 92% of our rides are under 30 minutes, so that has impacted our revenue stream.
What is your fare box recovery? And I looked at some of the larger cities, the peer cities of Seattle, 500,000 to, you know, 1.5 million. And the fare box recovery can be 80, you know, well above 75%, up to 100% for a couple of the best cities. What is it for? What is it?
We're nowhere near that. So we're at
25%. Yep.
And we're pleased with that when you look at what fare box recovery is in transportation in rural areas.
Yep.
We would much prefer to have that higher. I think one unique aspect that we have that we're struggling with is that our transportation in Aspen is fare subsidized, so it's free to the user. So you can get on a bus for free, but you can't get on a bike for free. And so that is something that we didn't expect would be such a challenge to our revenue stream, is this paradigm of, like, why do I have to pay for a bike? I can walk or take a bus for free.
But what is interesting what's interesting, Rich, is you are a sustainable system because you have the sponsorship and other funding resources. So you can plan around a lower fare box recovery and still make it work. Lindsay?
Correct. And to clarify on that, I think it's important because we have a lower fare box recovery and because we do have a free bus, quote-unquote free bus service, we are working towards getting more city financial annual participation, county transit authority participation to help offset that.
Great. Lindsay, why don't you follow up and then we'll do, quickly, and then we'll do another audience question.
Yeah, I was just going to add two things. So the fare box recovery, since we haven't gone through full, we need a little bit more time of our operations to figure out where we're at with that. So that was great that Marta answered that. I will say we're above projections for ridership as well as membership right now for the annual membership from the first year. So that's very exciting and all good signs for us to be doing very well. And I'll be interested to share with you all what our fare box recovery is when we get a little bit more of a grasp around that.
Yeah.
We certainly were looking at other fare box recoveries. I'll say when we did our feasibility study and implementation plan, which covered fare box recovery as well as our ridership projections and all of that, we asked the consultants to go more conservative with the numbers. They gave us what they thought, and then we asked them to even scale it back more, and I'm so glad we did that. We're exceeding those numbers, but it just overall makes our system look so much better, and we prepared for the worst. And getting the best has been wonderful. And I'll say one last thing about sponsorship. Don't underestimate the sponsorship, just like we spoke about. Regions Bank here, it's located here in Birmingham, headquartered here. Their main marketing campaign for the last 10 years has been a damn green bike, y'all. And you would think, man, that's a no-brainer that Regions would come on board as a sponsor. And it took a champion within that company who was on our task force and a ton of meetings and a ton of selling them about the benefits of bike share and connecting their brand with us to get that sponsorship. So do not underestimate that, even if it seems like a no-brainer.
Yep.
Quick question.
Let's do it.
Can somebody?
Oh. Yes. Laura,
hi. Sorry, I just had a quick question on the sponsorship. I was wondering where did you all get information on, you know, when you're valuing the price for the value of the ad spaces? And as you're going into negotiations with the different sponsors, how did you determine or negotiate the value of these ad spaces? What were your, like, models, or what kind of information were you looking at?
Let me jump in for 1 second on that. NABSA just did a survey in September, so we know from about 15 cities how much money they got for sponsorship, and we know that the average title sponsorship was about $1,000 a bike a year. And we know that with all the secondary sponsors, those added another $400 per bike per year on average. But and a couple things really important about that. Number one, you know, there were some small cities that were way in the lead or large cities. It wasn't like, you know, the biggest cities had the most money per bike, which was really interesting. The other interesting thing is, Philly and Portland most recently raised a heck of a lot more money than the average. The average might be going up. And now is a great time to fundraise because of that. Because those two just made so much money per bike, you can go out to a potential sponsor and say, Portland just got this.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's what we did, is we looked at other cities and looked at what funding they got in, but also what that funding included, because sometimes it would include bike lanes or something. And they would be like, well, yeah, they got millions and millions because it included additional infrastructure over the bike share program. So we really did our due diligence in asking other systems, and then we just sat down and just, luckily we have some great marketing, advertising, communications people. We sat down and really just kind of dialed in, and we did spend a lot of time, and then we had to be flexible. We had to negotiate. So what we wanted and what we got were two different things. But as long as it ended up being at $2.2 million, we were good. So,
yep.
So that's really what we looked at.
So if anyone's on mute and has a question, feel free to unmute. Mirta, do you have anything to add? Do you want to respond to that in a couple seconds while we wait for the next question?
Nope. I just say that it also is highly dependent on your market.
Yeah.
And what do you have, and what are your other advertising surfaces, and what are other ways that sponsorships are highly engaged in your area.
Let's take another question. Anyone have a question?
Hello, this is Sam Shelton with SACOG. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thanks for going in.
Oh, wonderful. Pound, one word. I have a question about relationships between the nonprofit and the cities, and maybe expectations for, say, performance indicators or level of service. How do you discuss whether or not a city wants more or less from bike share? If you're running it as a nonprofit, you may not have structural obligations or contractual obligations with the city.
And Mirta, I know you have a lot of experience with this. Why don't you take this one?
I think I'd encourage you from the get-go. Something that we didn't have the privilege of doing is we weren't able to set kind of expectations because it was all so unknown, and we were so eager to get the city to be a partner and to take this risk and get going and get on the ground and get rolling. That I would encourage you to set clear expectations as to what are your relationships, the benchmarks of your relationship, how will you be evaluated, and asking them to define what they want of you. Again, this concept of coming back to putting it in their words and in putting it, achieving their goals, and help them define how they will be evaluating you rather than doing it the other way around.
Are you running into challenges right now because you weren't able to complete those tasks early on?
Do you want to go ahead? Go ahead and follow up, Sam, with how we can clarify a little bit more for you.
Oh, you mentioned you wish you could have done it earlier. Are you running into specific challenges because you couldn't do it earlier?
Oh, well, so I think we didn't really, in terms of our relationship with the city, it was a very vague relationship to begin with, as we were this independent nonprofit. The biggest challenge we're running into with the city now is us asking them to be more of a partner, and they're responding to us by saying, well, you're a nonprofit, and we have to treat all nonprofits the same in our community. So it's clarifying, that you're a transportation nonprofit, helping them achieve a service. In our case, we're having to explain to them, we're helping them achieve a service that they would want, and for them to operate, it would cost them a lot more money than we're doing very frugally. And they're, because they are not able to articulate, in their case, what they are going to evaluate our success as. And
yeah.
So that's why I emphasize the importance of asking them what they want of you.
And I have some examples from Birmingham as well. I'll say contractually we set it up where they provided the match for capital. And even though they do not have any operational control, even connected to the fund, we all know that when the city gives you $400,000, that there are strings that you do not see attached to the fund. So we were very, we listened a lot in the very beginning about what was important to them, and that there are three things that came up for our mayor, and it was equity, safety, and including lower-income neighborhoods. And so I'll say this.
I think that we're hitting the equity and the safety piece. I actually had a meeting with the mayor Wednesday. I was very pleased with what we were doing, and I have plans to do in 2015. But one of the things that we are struggling with is hitting low-income residential areas with the initial rollout of our two phases. We thought we really explained to the city that we needed to make our core strong, which does include low-income neighborhoods. But it is, obviously, it was apparent to me later that it wasn't the neighborhoods he was talking about when he said low-income neighborhoods, right? So he wanted us to go more into the west of Birmingham, which we were not, which we've not done with our first two phases. And so that now is a priority, and that's something we haven't delivered on for the city, and that's something that they're looking for us to do. And if I don't get creative in some way very soon with that, and I say very soon, you know, I've got a year or so, but as we expand, if I don't address that, we probably are going to have some issues with this administration, even though this program has made this administration look very, very, very good and has done wonderful things for the city, and we've touted the city and put the mayor in front of this, you know, along the way. I would also recommend that. Don't forget your city council and your mayor at your launch and your press conferences. Always, when you can, put them in your quotes and in front, out front, which we did along the way, but really listen to what they're telling you. And from an operational standpoint, whether they have a contractual agreement with you on operations or not, that there's always some operational expectation from your city.
Right. And let's do one more question for now from the audience.
I have a quick question, because one of the things that we're battling right now, that's kind of like the one thing between us and closing a contract with the city, is helmet laws. So they're trying to decide how to interpret their helmet law. Here in Puerto Rico, sometimes it's a little fuzzy, and so we're trying to make an argument that it's going to be an obstacle if mm-hmm. they interpret the law to mean that it's universally obligatory to wear a helmet while you're cycling. Just wondering if you all have had any experience with helmet laws and giving advice on that.
I know I'm a moderator, but maybe I will respond because I'm in Seattle, and Seattle is the only city that has a mandatory helmet law that has bike share.
Mm-hmm.
And originally the city looked at sort of sophisticated solutions like a helmet vending machine where you that's integrated with the bike share system. All of that fell through. When we launched, right next to the station were two boxes. One was one where you could take a helmet for free, and in the box next to it, you could return the helmet. And, you know, the box cost about $1,500 to make, and they looked good. And it was an honor system, helmet system, and it worked. Everyone could get a helmet, everyone could return it, and the box was cheap. We did not lose a lot of helmets. So there is a simple solution if you are required to do it. The operations around helmets, I'm told they take a while to clean. But, you know, I think that can probably be streamlined a bit. You know, you could charge for the helmets and have a more sophisticated solution, but I will tell you there was something really nice about a simple solution. Even though the helmets are mandatory, you know, I think people took it as a suggestion, and probably the rate of helmet use is high. So it can be done. I don't think the helmet law in any way, shape, or form keeps the ridership down. I think the reality is people know that there's not much enforcement of a helmet law anyway, and if they're not going to wear a helmet, they're not going to wear a helmet, but they want to ride.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we did, because if you're over the age of 16, you're not required to wear a helmet in the state of Alabama, and if you're under the age of 16, you are required, is our city was actually thinking about making a mandatory helmet on the local level. And so we quickly went into action, talking with the city council, explaining to them very similar to the way you're doing. It possibly could be a barrier to bike share, and operationally, we did not prepare for that, so the funding that we would have to get for the capital as well as the operations for somebody to claim them wasn't built into the pro forma. And they were talking about helmet law like 3 months before we were going to launch. And so So we did convince them and get them to just point to the state law as our helmet law for now, but we obviously talked to them a lot about access and education because we encourage people to wear a helmet. So you will never see anything where we're not encouraging helmet use, but we want to provide access. So we're in the process of shoring up a helmet sponsor, and we'll be placing helmets at hotels, front desk, for them to come clean or provide hair necklaces if they would like, but they can have them for tourists, as well as working with some of our corporate sponsors and corporate companies and partners on having helmets there for their employees, and then working with retailers that don't normally carry helmets to carry ours for a much cheaper cost price. A lot of these best practices we got from Boston and from Nicole and when she was there. And so those are the way we talk a lot about education and access before regulation and making it mandatory. And that is MPA 101. You will be speaking their language when you say, let's start with access and education instead of regulation and ordinances.
So we have 2 minutes left before I wrap up. I want to have a request for everyone in the audience. If you can please send a very quick email, you can do it now while I am talking, and send it to the NABSA. Well, I'll give you my email, nicole.friedman@seattle.gov, nicole.friedman@seattle.gov. Send me an email right now and just tell me, does this Q&A interactive format work for you? Should we do it in the future? Do you prefer a PowerPoint standard webinar? Just, you know, quick thing, how do they compare? Did it work? We want to know. And with our 1 minute left, I want 2 seconds from Mirta and Lindsay. Number one thing you recommend to any small or mid-sized city.
Can I say this real quick? Hey, Matt.
Yeah.
Could you put it on the last slide that has our contact information on it so you can contact either one of us as well with any questions you have afterwards? I think that's the next slide. And so we've provided our email addresses as well.
Got it. Number one thing you recommend.
Partnerships.
Great.
Public-private.
I would say, well, since you said partnerships, because that's a great one, I would say, one of the things that we did was we went risky with innovation and technology, and I would not be afraid of doing that, even as a small to begin subsidy. We are great incubators for new technology that's coming down the pipeline for bike sharing, for many other things. And so I would, and that's a great way to make yourself, as a small to medium-sized city, stand out and doing something really amazing that larger cities haven't done. And so I would say do not shy away from innovation and technology and really, really look at those operations in advance. Reach out to the network that exists within the bike share industry.
Wonderful. Lindsay, Mirta, thank you both so much. Everyone, you have their contact information. Please send an email so we have your feedback. Again, it's nicole.friedman@seattle.gov, and we look forward to talking with all of you at our next webinar at the date that I cannot remember. So I am terrible at sales, but thank you all, and I hope you have a fantastic weekend. Goodbye.
Thank you, Nicole, and thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.